thank you so much for inviting me. This is a great conference. I'm having a very good time, and I'm really glad that Jim's walked in, because I'm going to say some nice things about him. Some of you will know why there's a picture of a pigeon there. I might come back to the pigeon later. this is a short, simplistic, not especially original talk. But my purpose in giving it to you is that I think that there's still a serious problem of mental causation out there, and it seems to me that the debate about mental causation is kind of ignoring this problem. There's still a problem that people have fixed another problem, but they haven't fixed a sort of an underlying problem, which I think needs some attention. So given that I'm in a room with a lot of very eminent philosophers of causation, I thought this might be the time to impress upon them the thought that more work needs to be done. So, seems to me that there are two problems of mental causation. There are probably a lot more than two, but these are the two I'm interested in. One of them I'm calling the multiple realization problem, which kind of goes like this. Look, if mental properties are multiply realized by physical properties, as non-reductive physicalists maintain, how can those mental properties be causally relevant to any effects given the closure of the physical and no widespread overdetermination? It seems that the physical properties would be doing all the work by themselves with no assistance from the mental. I'm going to come back to that problem. So that's one problem of mental causation. Here's a second problem of mental causation. I'm calling it the functionalism problem. Why are mental properties multiply realizable? They're multiply realizable because they're defined in terms of their causal roles. So, for example, to be in pain is to be in some state that typically has certain causes and effects. That's just how functionalists define what it is to be in pain. And that's the reason why pain turns out to be a multiply realizable property, because many kinds of physical state can, in principle, play that causal role in different people or in the same person at different times or whatever. So here's the problem, that mental properties are not fully distinct from the properties of their effects, because mental property, to have a certain mental property, is to stand in a certain kind of causal relation to some other property. So it looks as though mental properties are just unsuited for causal relevance. Looks like the counterfactual dependence between mental causes and mental or physical effects can't be causal dependence. So we have counterfactual dependence, but it looks like it's a non-causal kind of dependence. So I think this really is a major problem, and there's not a lot of point in solving the multiple realization problem if we can't solve the problem with the very position, namely functionalism, that was grounds for endorsing multiple realization in the first place. So existing accounts that solve the multiple realization problem, let's assume, are going to work for some multiply realized properties, but they're not going to work for functionally specified ones. So if you think about Sophie the pigeon, who I showed you at the beginning, she wasn't pecking because she's trained to peck at red things, and she was confronted by a sort of gray pebble. Stephen Yablo has a very well-known paper where he argues that determinates like scarlet and crimson and maroon don't compete for causal status with their determinables, namely redness. So the idea is that we can perfectly happily say that when Sophie's pecking at the red pebble, the redness is causally relevant to the pecking, even though there's some specific shade of red that the pebble is, that in some sense maybe she's also causally responding to. I think there's a similar problem when we think about Sophie, because most people think that redness, that colors themselves, are dispositional properties, right? So to be red is to be disposed to have certain kinds of effects on beings like us. So again, it looks as though even if Yablo's right about the idea that in principle determinants and determinables don't compete for causal status, seems to me that there's a particular problem when it comes to things like color properties. If you want to endorse the idea that colors are dispositions, because it looks as though dispositional properties themselves are unsuited to be causally relevant properties, because something's being red is not going to be fully distinct from the various effects of its being red. Okay, so here's the gist of the talk. I want to claim boldly that the multiple realization problem is pretty much sorted out. Yay. But none of those solutions that are on the table at the moment resolve the functionalism problem. They just leave that completely to one side. The bold consequence that I'm going to try a little bit to motivate is that we should in fact embrace epiphenomenalism. We should embrace the view that functionally defined mental properties lack causal relevance to anything. And before you throw your hands up in horror, I don't think that's nearly as bad as it sounds. So I'm competing with Sarah in the kind of try and defend a philosophical thesis that most people think sounds a little bit crazy. I'm not sure. You can decide which one of us wins that battle when we get to the end. So in a sense, none of this is really very original. Some people have been worrying about the functionalism problem in recent years. So Richard Rupert has a paper on this. Jack Lyons has a paper on it. Gabriel Siegel has a paper on it. Jack Lyons and Gabriel Siegel both go the epiphenomenalism way. Richard Rupert kind of junks the functionalism. I'm toying with the idea of going the epiphenomenalist way. I'm kind of not really sold on it, so I'd be quite happy if you persuaded me that there was a better way of resolving this problem. But as I say, I don't think the epiphenomenalism way of going is quite as bad as it might look. So here's the exclusion problem. Most of you will be familiar with this. We have an argument with various premises, the first of which is the closure of physics. So every event has a sufficient physical cause. That's to say the physical properties of some event plus some other physical conditions are going to be causally sufficient for every effect. So any effect you like is going to have some causally sufficient collection of physical properties that are instantiated by various objects and events that are causally sufficient for that effect. We have a no widespread overdetermination premise. Mostly, although of course not always, events are not overdetermined. Occasionally you get overdetermination, firing squads and cases like that, but by and large, we don't get overdetermination. That's to say, we don't normally find ourselves in a situation where there's more than one causally sufficient condition. And the third premise is a distinctness thesis, the claim that mental and physical properties are not identical to each other, and that's the central tenet of non-reductive physicalism. What follows from those three premises, what's supposed to follow, is that mental properties are epiphenomenal, and that's supposed to be bad news, obviously. So, oops, did I just miss something? So, it looks like it's the distinctness. So I'm just thinking about the problem of multiple realization, what I'm calling the problem of multiple realization here, which is in effect the way that the exclusion problem is normally cashed out. So what's causing the problem here? It's the distinctness of mental physical properties that's turning out to be the problem for non-reductive physicalism. If our mental property M were identical to some physical property P, then M would be causally relevant to some effect E just by virtue of the fact that P is, right? M is the very same property as P, so the causal relevance of P guarantees the causal relevance of M. But the barrier to embracing the claim that mental properties just are physical properties is multiple realization. So plausibly being in pain is something that can be realized by various different physical properties, as I say, maybe in different species, maybe across single species, maybe in the same person at different times. Maybe the physical property that realizes my being in pain today when you stick a pin in my arm is different to the physical property that realizes my being in pain tomorrow when I, stub my toe or something. No particular reason to think that that's going to be the very same physical property in each case. So, solving the multiple realization problem, quite a lot of work has gone on in this regard recently. So we have Stephen Yablo's kind of original paper from the 1990s, John Campbell has written about this, Jim Woodward has written about this, Christian List and Peter Menzies have done it as well. All of those attempted solutions focus on the notion of causation as difference-making, and mostly conceived along broadly interventionist lines. So the basic idea just goes like this. Suppose that this is a very, very flaky way of describing what's going on. Suppose the distribution of property M supervenes on but is not identical with the distribution of physical properties P1, P2, and so on, in such a way that M is multiply realized by those different properties. Effect E can perfectly well counterfactually depend on M, despite the causal closure of the physical. Why is that? All right, and counterfactual dependence just is the kind of notion of difference making. And why is that? It's because roughly, in considering what would have happened in the absence of the mental property, we don't hold the presence of its realizer fixed. We can't hold it realized or fixed because the mental property supervenes on the physical property, right? So if you try and think away the mental property, you're going to have to think away the physical property as well. And so that means that you end up with a perfectly nice counterfactual dependence of the effect on the mental property. So the mere fact that property P1, let's say, which in this case is the property that's realizing mental property M, the mere fact that that property in the circumstances is causally sufficient for the effect is perfectly well compatible with the truth of the claim that if M hadn't been present, E wouldn't have been present either, right? So we get counterfactual dependence. It looks like it's perfectly good counterfactual dependence of a causal kind, or so you might think so far. So no bar to saying that M is straightforwardly causally relevant to E. So more precisely, and this is a bit closer to Jim's version of a solution, we want to know whether M causes E, where M is multiply realized by various different physical properties. That depends on whether intervening on M is going to change the value of E. Normally, an intervention has to be independent of all other causes of E. The other causes of E, you have to kind of hold fixed at their actual value. We can't do that in this case because any intervention on M is a fortiori going to be an intervention on its underlying physical basis. Right? You can't alter someone's mental state without altering the physical state that realizes that mental state. But Jim says, look, we can and should extend the notion of an intervention to relax that requirement. All we really need is that an intervention has to be independent of other distinct causes of the effect, and of course M and P1 are not fully distinct because of supervenience. There's a non-causal counterfactual dependence between M and its realizer, which shows us that those two things are not fully distinct. Now, I basically think that that's sort of works, pretty much. I mean, there are some in-house disputes here between the various people who are attempting to solve the problem in this way, but it seems to me that particularly the version that Jim has either just does the job or it maybe needs a bit of tweaking, I don't know, but we're pretty much there with the multiple realization problem, I think, which is marvelous. Excellent. Multiple realization per se is no bar to causal status. That's the kind of view that Stephen Yablo was gesturing at quite a while ago. I think now we're at the position where people have kind of figured out the details of how this is supposed to work, and it strikes me that that's kind of pretty convincing. But now here's the problem. Why did we think that mental properties are multiply realizable in the first place? Answer, it's because of functionalism, right? Mental properties are defined in terms of their causal role. So to be in pain or whatever is to be in some state or other that has certain typical causes and effects. But in that case, it looks as though the counterfactual dependence between being in pain and, for example, exhibiting some piece of pain behavior, saying ouch, for example, is going to be non-causal dependence. Right, because to be in pain just is to be in some physical state that causes that kind of behavior. So, the functionalism problem. More generally, so this is a slightly different way of putting the same point, or maybe a way of putting a slightly different but closely related point. Functionally defined properties are extrinsic properties. They're instantiated by virtue of the causal role that their realizers play. And extrinsic properties, quite generally, are not apt for having causal status precisely because they give rise to non-causal counterfactual dependence. So let's put this in Lewisian terms. Here's how you might do it in kind of Lewis speak. We might cash out the causal relevance of properties in terms of the essential properties of events. So we might say something like this. Property F is token causally relevant to some particular effect E, if and only if E counterfactually depends on an event that has F as an essential property. So Lewis's story about events is that events are basically kind of sets of spatio-temporal regions across possible worlds. So the very same spatial region can have an awful lot of events going on at it, depending on what the essential properties of the event are. And the difference in essential properties makes for a difference in which possible world that event occurs at. So, for example, John says hello loudly. We don't just have one event going on there. We have several events. For example, we have the event that's essentially specified as John saying hello loudly. We also have the event that's merely essentially John saying hello. And those two events, because John saying hello happens at various possible worlds where he only says hello quietly rather than loudly, those two different events are going to have different causes and effects. So, for example, John's saying hello might cause you to say hello back, but his saying hello loudly might not cause you to say hello back, because it might be that if he'd merely said hello quietly, so John saying hello loudly hadn't occurred, you still would have said hello back, right, unless you were quite hard of hearing, in which case that wouldn't work out. Right, so take a spatiotemporal region, it's going to have lots and lots and lots of different events going on. Some of those events, as it were, in the actual world, are going to have all the same properties, but they're going to differ with respect to which of those properties are essential and which of them are accidental, right? So the thought is, look, we can extract a notion of causal relevance of properties out of this. A property gets to be causally relevant to an effect just if the effect counterfactually depends on an event that has F as an essential property. The loudness of John saying hello gets to be causally relevant to some effect just if that effect counterfactually depends on an event that has the loudness of the saying hello as an essential feature. Now, here's the worry. Extrinsic properties, Lewis argues, can't feature. Extrinsic properties can't feature as essential properties of events. We can only specify the essential features of events in terms of intrinsic properties. Why is that? It's because you end up with non-causal counterfactual dependence if you allow events to be essentially specified in terms of extrinsic properties. So, now, of course, you can sensibly ask counterfactual questions about, for example, what would have happened had I not been in pain, but there's no event that's essentially characterizable as my being in pain, and so the answer to that counterfactual question isn't going to give us a handle on the causal relevance of being in pain, right? So it might perfectly well be true that if I hadn't been in pain, I wouldn't have said ouch, right? That doesn't show that being in pain is causally relevant to my having said ouch, because there just is no event that's essentially specifiable as my being in pain, because my being in pain is an extrinsic property. Right, so we get non-causal counterfactual dependence there, and hence no causal relevance of the mental property. So securing the counterfactual dependence of some effect E on the obtaining of some mental property can't establish that that property is causally relevant to E. So now, let's think about how bad embracing epiphenomenalism would be. There's a heading here which is not going to appear until later because I forgot to check my ordering. Anyway, the heading says something like, it's not as bad as the following kind of epiphenomenalism. So here's one way in which something can be epiphenomenal. It's the kind of epiphenomenalism I think you get if you embrace an account of qualia of the kind that you kind of originally get in Jackson's epiphenomenal qualia. So qualia are supposed to be the kind of phenomenological feel of various states. The fact that I'm now talking about pains and mental states and things is kind of irrelevant. Okay, I could have been talking about something else. It's just that it's kind of nice to talk about zombies, so I'm using this example. But it just so happens that this is an example about mental states as well, but that's not to the point. So suppose you're a believer in qualia. One of the things that's supposed to motivate this thought is the idea that, look, you could have a zombie twin that was physically completely identical to you, behaved in all of the same ways as you do, and yet had no phenomenal states, right? There's nothing it would be like to be your zombie twin. Now, if that's the case, right, so and then the idea is the difference between you and your zombie twin is there is something that it's like for you to be you, whereas there's nothing for it's like for your zombie twin to be them. We have the existence of qualia, the what it's likeness, but those qualia are completely epiphenomenal, right? In particular, if you try and explain the behavior of your zombie twin, you can completely explain all of the behavior of your zombie twin, right? All of the zombie twin's behavior is completely explained by their physical states. In particular, when your zombie twin goes around saying, ouch, that really hurt, or gosh, isn't it interesting that I have all of these phenomenal states, right? This is a bit of physical behavior, right? The zombie twin's wrong about that, doesn't have any phenomenal states, but because your zombie twin is supposed to exhibit all the same behavior as you, she will indeed say things like, gosh, there really is something like it's like to be me, right? Wrong about that. very weird. So in the zombie twin's case, it looks like her behavior is completely explained in terms of all of her physical states, right? It has to be because the zombie twin doesn't have any phenomenal states. And because of that, it looks as though it's unclear how appeal to qualia could play any role in explaining my behavior, right? My behavior has the same non-phenomenal causes as my zombie twin's behavior. My zombie twin's behavior is entirely explainable in terms of its non-phenomenal state. It's her non-phenomenal states. So it looks as though my behavior also ought to be completely explainable in terms of my non-phenomenal states. So, oh, there we are, bad epiphenomenalism. So by contrast to the qualia situation, if non-reductive physicalism is true, we don't get an analog of the zombie twin, right? There is no being that's physically identical to me, behaves in the same ways, and so on and so on and so on, but has no mental states, right? That's because that would violate the supervenience thesis that non-reductive physicalists are signed up to. People who believe in qualia are not signed up to a supervenience thesis, right? They precisely think that qualia don't supervene on other states. That's why you get to have zombie twins. Because it seems to me that because there's no zombie twin analog in the case of non-reductive physicalism, there isn't really any motivation for saying that non-reductive physicalism style mental states that are defined in terms of their causal roles, are explanatorily redundant, right? You don't get the kind of redundancy that you get with the case where there's a kind of zombie twin of you, right? Because there's no kind of other being that has all the same physical states but none of the mental states whose behavior is completely explicable, right? There is no such being because that violates supervenience. So, it seems to me that you don't get explanatory redundancy by embracing the kind of epiphenomenalism you would get with non-reductive physicalism. How can epiphenomenal mental features explain things? Well, you know, here's a bit of appeal to Lewis again. Lewis's central thought when it comes to causal explanation is that to causally explain an event is to provide information about its causal history. Seems to me that functionalism-style mental properties satisfy that requirement. When I explain your behavior by saying that you're in pain, I do give some information about the causal history of your behavior. In effect, I'm telling you that I'm saying that it was caused by some physical feature or other that typically plays the pain role, right? That's to say something about the causal history of your behavior. And it contrasts with other ways I might explain your behavior. For example, I might be explaining your behavior by saying that you're just pretending, or that's just the way you look when you're thinking really hard, kind of pained expression, whatever it is, right? So it's not a completely sort of pointless explanation that I'm giving, and moreover, it seems to me that I'm giving information about the causal history of your behavior, and that's, if we think of that as the kind of the basic standard that causal explanations have to live up to, then it looks as though we still get to use mental features to explain things. Okay. Another reason to think that epiphenomenalism of this kind isn't as bad as it sounds. Look, I've written it's not as bad as it sounds twice. So this is twice as convincing. Mental events, at least in some sense, still cause things. I've been teaching Frankfurt cases. Jones's decision to kill Smith had terrible consequences. That claim is true, even if mental states are epiphenomenal. Jane's desire for coffee caused her to drink too much of it, and so on. Why are those claims true? Because the expression Jones's decision to kill Smith picks out an event, and it's an event that has certain physical characteristics, and those physical characteristics were indeed causally relevant to the terrible consequences that ensued. Jane's desire for coffee is some sort of mental state or event. Describing it as a desire for coffee is to describe it in terms of extrinsic features, but of course there is a physical event that has a being of a desire for coffee as an accidental feature, and that event really does cause Jane to drink too much coffee. Now, admittedly, those events only get to cause those effects by virtue of their physical features, viz. Those features that can count as essential properties of events. So mental events are only kind of accidentally mental. Nonetheless, the mere fact that they're only accidentally mental doesn't make those sorts of claims come out false, right? They're going to come out true. Just as it's true that the event reported on the front page of yesterday's Guardian caused havoc to the railway systems of Europe, right? That claim is just true. There is no event that's essentially specifiable as the event recorded on the reported on the front page of the Guardian. Nonetheless, it's true that the event reported on the front page of the Guardian had those effects. Okay. Here's kind of another version of epiphenomenalism that that contrasts, I think, with the kind that I'm wanting to provisionally endorse. Look, suppose we can perfectly well and identify and intervene on some physical property P, and that P causes E. Now, look, let's just define up a new property, call it P star. To have P star is to have a property that is a cause of E, right? Right. Now, P star is, in some kind of obvious sense, I think, a useless property. In the following sense, if we're interested in manipulating and controlling E, P star doesn't help us in the slightest because we could already do that, right? We could already perfectly well do that by intervening on P. P is a property that we can identify and we can manipulate by assumption. So thinking or behaving in terms of P star just doesn't help us, right, at all. Now, again, that's not how things are with mental properties, even if mental properties are epiphenomenal in this sense. In the case of mental properties, by and large, we can't identify or intervene on the physical properties directly. We have to go via the mental property. So it looks as though there's no motivation for saying that non-reductive physicalism-style mental states are useless in the way that P star is kind of a useless property. So, for example, let me just say a little bit more about the kind of notion of control that's going on here. Look, we normally control our own and other people's behavior by intervening. I put intervening in scare quotes on mental properties. That's just a fact about the way that we interact with each other. There are exceptions to this, right? Drugs, neurosurgery. Those are interventions on the sort of the physical realizers and not the mental properties. Now, does the obvious truth that we normally control our own and other people's behavior by intervening on mental properties commit us to saying that mental properties have causal status? I want to say no. So I'm not sure if this is a helpful analogy, but let's see. Look, sometimes you want a writing implement and you want it now, right? Someone's giving you their phone number and you don't have nothing to write with, or you've just seen an accident and you need to take down the registration number of the car. What you want is something that plays a certain causal role, right? You have no interest, well, not very much interest in its implementation. If someone handed you a massive slate and a kind of something, right, that might not be the kind of thing that you were looking for, but pretty much you don't care what realizes that causal role. You just want something that realizes the causal role. That's entirely consistent with the idea that the having of that causal role itself is not part of the causal story, right? We don't have to ascribe the having of the causal role, the being the kind of thing with which you can write down a car registration number, as itself something that is causally relevant to my then writing down the car number plate, in order to make sense of my request for a writing implement, right? We just don't need to do that. So think about a mental case. So I don't have a pet dog, but imagine I did. Here's my pet dog exhibiting pain behavior. What's the likely cause of that? Well, look, the likely cause is the dog is in some neural state or other that has certain typical causes and is in turn causing said pain behavior. What am I going to do about that? Well, I shall locate the cause of the neural state. Having done that, I'm going to remove the thorn from the dog's paw. I have no idea what that neural state was, right? No idea at all. I have no idea how removing the thorn caused the dog's brain to go from some neural state that realizes pain to some other neural state that doesn't realize pain. No idea how that works. That's why the concept of pain is a useful concept to have, right? So I intervened in some loose sense of intervention, maybe a slightly metaphorical sense of intervention, on a mental property of the dog, kind of strictly speaking, what I did was I intervened on its physical state, despite not even knowing what that physical state was. The intervention worked, and that's kind of all we need, right? It seems to me that we can make sense of the idea that we control, predict, explain our own and other people's behaviors by appealing to mental properties. We can accept all of that without having to believe that those properties are causally relevant to anything. That's the basic thought. So, conclusion, the functionalism problem hasn't been solved. I kind of tentatively think that we should just embrace epiphenomenalism. We still get explanatory non-redundancy. We still get the causal status of admittedly accidental mental events. We get the usefulness of the mental. In general, we can only intervene on the physical realizers by intervening on the mental properties, and that's really not so bad. But you may take a different view.